One more time. We're in the temple with Jesus during Holy Week, the last week of his life. Once again, in the temple, the courts of the temple, this area of about 40 acres in Jerusalem, where people gather to converse, to study, to pray, as well as to worship in the various courts of prayer, and where once a year the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies. This big space in Jerusalem, the center of the world for the Jewish people, Jesus is spending his last week on earth, day by day, in the temple. He's been mixing it up with different kinds of people, but especially with Pharisees and Sadducees and other religious leaders. Today we hear that having one around with the Sadducees, the Pharisees come for him again. They get together and one of them, a lawyer, it says, seeks to test him. What's the difference between a test, a trial, and a temptation? We sometimes use them synonymously in biblical translation. We hear them a little differently. We know about Jesus' temptations in the wilderness. We tend to think of temptation as something that's really appealing, as opposed to something that you just have to kind of slog through. But really, they all come from the same roots and the same words in the original Greek. Jesus is tempted in the wilderness. We could also say he's tested in the wilderness. He undergoes some trials in the wilderness. The same word appears here. These folks seek to test him. For just a moment, I want to think about the prayer we pray together at least once a week, the prayer that Jesus himself taught us. In the traditional version, which we'll pray together here in a few moments, the petition is, "Lead us not into temptation," which kind of sounds like God would throw us into something. This is one place where I love the traditional version very much, know it by heart, and have since I was a little kid. Maybe you have too. In the more contemporary version, which we use sometimes here in public worship, that petition is translated, "Save us from the time of trial," which doesn't mean keep us from ever having anything difficult. It means when we're in the middle of it, deliver us through to the other side. Save us out of it. Save us from it, through the midst of it. That's God's business, right? Making a way where there is no way. Going with us through things we can't have imagined would ever happen, much less envision how we will get through. That's God's business. That's what it means for God to be God. There are some things about which the people of God across the generations seem to be able to agree. And that's what we find in this gospel text. After all these arguments with all these people, all these questions designed to trip him up, which he always skillfully responds to, sometimes answering a question with a question, Jesus is asked, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment?" You know it by heart too, don't you? Love God with all your heart and mind and soul. And he quickly adds, and there's a second one very much like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. The poet Wendell Berry would hasten to tell us, love your neighbors, the ones you have, not the ones you pick out. For once, there's agreement. The Pharisees have nothing to say in contradiction. My goodness, this rabbi has given us the most orthodox answer we've ever heard, and we quite agree. For all the ways they disagreed, they agreed on the heart of their tradition. What does it mean to be children of this God who always brings us through. It means to honor these commandments and to keep them best we can with God's help every single day. Love God, love neighbor. Jesus then, I guess, can't help himself, and so he asks them a question, which is a big puzzle for them. How can David call the Messiah his son and his Lord? And we know the answer. Jesus, Son of God, Son of Man, Son of David, of David's line, is the Messiah. It was a little tricky for them, and they stopped asking him questions after that. But we still ask him questions, don't we? Do you have days where you say, Lord, what is it with you and these commandments? How in the world am I supposed to love some of these people? How in the world am I supposed to make it through a world where there's so much violence that seems completely unnecessary? How am I supposed to make it through the day when I'm carrying news that breaks my heart? How, God, how? How do I keep loving God and loving neighbor? How do I make it through this test? Will you see me through this time? I want to believe it. Can I believe it? Will you still be faithful? And we have two other readings today that remind us that indeed God is faithful. God will see us through. That's what it means for God to be God. God will walk with us through the worst of all and bring us out on the other side. Maybe not in a way we could ever have imagined, but in a way that will restore life and hope, faith and love. It's hard to be patient, though, and walk that walk with God sometimes and walk that walk with one another sometimes. We like things fast. I love a microwave. I love that in my house in Georgia, where it actually gets cold, I have a remote control that turns on the gas logs. I like it quick. But most of this spiritual stuff is slow, slow, slow. So let's think about Moses in that first reading. Moses, who had had the most phenomenal life story, and I won't rehearse it all for you, but we've been sort of narrating it as we have come along. No one would have predicted that this stuttering, adopted child of the daughter of Pharaoh would become the leader of the people of Israel. And yet, that's what happened. And God saw him through, and he put up with and figured how to love the very disorganized children of Israel after they crossed the Red Sea, wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years while they murmured and rumored and murmured and griped and complained about all kinds of things, but they made it through at last, except Moses, who did all the work, prayed all the prayers, did everything God asked, could see where they were going from atop Mount Nebo, could look across the Jordan River and see the promised land. It had been promised to them from way back to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their descendants forever. But he wasn't allowed to cross into it. He had done his part. To me, the reason it's stated elsewhere that he wasn't allowed to cross in is a little sketchy. After doing almost everything entirely correctly and exactly as God had said, there's that one time where God says, touch the rock, and he's had a bad day and he whacks it a little too hard. That's the stated reason. I don't find that adequate. But anyway, there's Moses looking over to see where the people he has been leading will go on without him, carrying on. And God has created a succession plan. Everything is not going to fall apart because Joshua has also been chosen by God. Moses has laid hands on him and appointed him the next key leader of the people of Israel. The people will be in good hands. Joshua will finish and lead them into that land where everything they had been promised will become theirs. But Moses stops on the mountain. Do you recall the famous usage of this image? in a speech, which is really a sermon known as the Mountaintop Speech, delivered by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. the night before he was assassinated, April 3rd, 1968. And he said, "I may not make it with you there. I may not go all the way with you, but I've been to the mountain. I've seen the promised land. I've seen where we're going. And even though I personally won't see it fulfilled, I live and breathe. I hope for the day. I believe for the day when some of you will see this promise fully enacted from the mountaintop." God saw Moses through, not in a way Moses or we could ever have imagined. And God saw the people through as Moses passed the torch, or in this case, passed the staff to Joshua to lead the people through the next season. Our patron Paul, in his first letter to the church at Thessaloniki, or however you want to say it, in Greece, he's at his pastoral best in this letter. It's the oldest letter of Paul's that we have. He may have written others before it, but this is the oldest one that we have. And he, last week we heard his greeting and how he expressed the love and affection that he and his partners in ministry, Silvanus and Timothy, how much they care for this congregation, Thessaloniki, for these Thessalonians. And today he's telling them about the work that they have that is theirs to do together, cooperatively, each person exercising their gifts and each person exercising leadership in their own way, mobilizing the people of God to do the work of God in their local context. He's not lording it over them. He's not pretending to be the boss of them. He's saying, "You've seen what we're about. We've never asked you to do anything we're not willing to do ourselves. We've been transparent with you. We've been honest with you. We didn't come hat in hand looking for you to pay all our expenses. We came to be with you and cultivate a relationship with you as we all together follow Jesus the Christ. We've become very fond of you," or as it says in our translation, "y'all have become very dear to us." It's not that he's not their pastor exactly, it's that in this case he's really emphasizing how everybody together are co-laborers and how if everybody does their part once again, in a way nobody could have predicted, but everyone can experience, God will see them through a difficult time. Faith, hope, and charity, he says. We need these, and we've just prayed at the beginning of our service that God will stir up in us those gifts, and that God will make us love what God commands. Let's think about if we really want that prayer to come true. Jesus says, back to the gospel, "On these two commandments, love God, love neighbor, hang all the law and the prophets." All 613 laws of the Torah rest upon those. Everything that all the prophets taught, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Micah, Hosea, all of them, on these two hang all the law and the prophets. Love God, love neighbor. So I have to tell you this quote that makes me catch my breath and pulls me up short every time I read it. It's from one of the great Christian saints of the 20th century, a Roman Catholic laywoman named Dorothy Day. She was the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She walked her talk. She entered a life of voluntary poverty and worked alongside other people who were just barely getting by. She advocated for them, and she worked and prayed and ate and lived alongside them. Love God, love neighbor. They might be more closely related than we are comfortable with. Dorothy Day said it this way: "I really only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. I really only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. Did somebody just pop in your mind? What's your relationship with that person? Is there anything on your side that could be done to make it different? I really only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. Gets me every time. What a great one-line sermon. Faith, hope, and charity. These are gifts entrusted to us. These are gifts that we need to continue to stir up in ourselves and in one another. Love God, love neighbor. Where we experience love, I don't mean some sappy, sentimental something, but where we experience loving kindness, compassion, mercy, empathy, where we experience those things, where we participate in those things, God is there. Some of you are familiar with the music from the French community in Taizé, France. Some maybe not so much. But I want to close with all of us singing in a prayerful way one of the most familiar chants from the Taizé community. It's in Latin. Ubi caritas et amor. Ubi caritas. Deus ibi est. Where charity and love are found, God is there. Sing along with Tim and me and Dean. Pick it up if you can. And if you don't want to sing it, just pray on it. Where charity and love are found, God is there.
Ubi caritas et amor.